and perhaps we'll, I have questions for you. I know you've had some material on chemoreception, and hopefully I can correct what you said.
He'll correct my life.
And hopefully you have some questions for me as well. Just so I can walk around.
If it works, that is.
I did earlier.
Ah, here we go. Well, faction versus taste. What's the difference? Now I know that you guys have done the taste test where you hold your nose, right? Put a powerful taste on your tongue and experience the fact that most of what you taste in food is actually the sense of smell, the smell of the food. And that smell of food is through what's called retronasal olfaction, where the pathway is not out of the mouth into the nose so much, but back up through the connection in the back of the throat, from the throat back up into the nasal cavity. You know this word, retronasal? I'll put it up here just in case. Not that it's going to be that important, but sort of cool to know. If you end up in healthcare and somebody comes to you and says that they're having trouble tasting things, things don't taste well. Because of your experience with those red hots, you should already know that it's most likely that their taste deficit is actually a smell deficit. And if you're not a physician, if you're working at some other aspect in healthcare, you should refer those patients to a physician, right? Because loss of sense of smell is a serious health concern. People who lose their sense of smell, especially if they're aged, are have an increased probability of being Parkinsonism or Alzheimer's disease or any dementia patient, actually. It's one of the first signals of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and other forms of dementia. So be aware of that if you go on to a healthcare career. Sometimes I'm asked this question: what's the difference between taste and smell? How do you define it? And you really have to get into lots of details about the reception systems in order to define it carefully. But for most cases, taste is contact chemoreception, where the source of the chemical being sensed is actually physically against the organism. Right? Take a catfish, for example. Catfish have taste buds all over their bodies. They can taste something they bump up against. But they also have an olfactory sense that detects things in the water that come from distant sources. And so, rough working definitions, taste is contact, olfaction is distance. And that will get you through most situations, although I'm sure that some of you can imagine situations where that's not really true. So, before I go further, any questions about smell and taste? Things that you're curious about? Smell and taste.
Can you taste a vapor?
Can you taste a vapor? If you can get it to condense on your tongue, that you could taste it. You have to get that vapor in contact with the tongue at fairly high concentration. Taste works at much higher concentrations of the chemicals than olfaction does, right? Because the source is usually right in contact with you. Other questions? Yes?
So when you're saying condensing, like sometimes people will smell things that are so strong, they describe it as like they can taste it. Is that because it's like such a high concentration of molecules in your nasal cavity that it runs back down to your throat? Or is that just like a confusion of like perception?
It could be either. It could also be irritant, stimulation of the trigeminal system that makes you feel like you're getting a sensation from the mouth area. But all those things are possible causes. If you think of more, just stop me. We can talk about just about anything. It's the last day of class, after all, for goodness sake. I'm surprised they aren't saying, can we go outside? A little cool for that. So what's unique about smell? Or nearly so? What can you think of that smell does that nowhere else, nothing else in the body does?
Physiological sense, or?
Sure, why not?
Well, what trigger emotional response, what trigger memories?
Odors triggering emotional responses and memories. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that as we go on here. Other things that are unique. Don't think too hard. We're talking simple things here.
I guess just the type of stimulus.
The stimulus, right. It detects odors. Nowhere else in the body detects odors, right? Duh. There is at least one other thing that the olfactory system is famous for that's nearly unique, which is an oxymoron, I know, but forgive me. How about this? The ability to make new neurons, even in old farts like me. It's amazing. How many different odor chemicals can you detect? I'll make this easy. Make a multiple choice. Write down an answer. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay. How many for about 100? Whoa. How many for about 500? How many for about 1,000 odors? 1. How many for about 10,000? About 6, 7 of you. How many for lots? More than 10,000. Wow. At least you got something right here. It is a lot. At least 10,000, if not more. Right? Lots and lots of different chemicals you can detect. Right? And we're not all that famous for being good smellers, for being having good olfactory senses, are we, as humans? But don't sell yourself short. Our sense of smell is actually quite good. More about odors. If I went to the chemistry lab down the street and synthesized a compound that's volatile, that will dissolve in air, but it's a compound that had never before been present on Earth, and this has actually been done many times, would you be able to smell it? Right. Novel chemical, it's volatile, but it's never before been present on Earth. Could you smell it? Yes? No? What do we think?
It's completely original. It's not using the components that are currently here.
Well, you certainly have to use stuff that's here, but it's a chemical compound like this one, right? It looks like this, but it's novel. Never before been present. Yeah. Maybe it's got 2 chlorines on it. Oh, that wouldn't work. That wouldn't be soluble in air. It wouldn't be volatile. But something like that. He says, yeah. Who wants to slap him down and tell him there's no way? Nobody's willing to do that, huh?
Well, he's right.
It's been done several times. You can make a novel compound, probably never before present on Earth, and we can smell it if it's volatile. Okay. It's sort of amazing in that sense. What does that tell you about the evolution of the receptors in your nose? About the evolution of mammalian receptors in general? You can detect something that's completely novel. I'm sorry, I can't hear.
So
I'm old, you know.
They evolve rapidly. I mean, they can detect something you've never been able to detect before. That must mean that they're changing from where they're
quickly? And those are both great ideas, and they're both true, although the system's not changing, you know, in a few seconds time when it's experienced the new compound. But in fact, neural factor systems evolve in an environment where chemicals were evolving. Right? Plants are making new defense compounds, new attractants for pollinators. Animals are evolving, giving off new and different smells. The system evolved to be able to detect novelty, to keep up with evolution. So the receptors have a very wide range of capacities for detecting odors. And this fits, of course, with the fact that you can detect more than 10,000 different compounds. The two things go hand in hand. Odorants. Right. For us, they're all things that are volatile in air. For crayfish or a lobster or a catfish, these are things that can dissolve in water, right, for the most part. And these are just many examples of relatively famous odorants, all of these. As is this. Right. Think cooking. Think pumpkin pie. Anyone have an idea what this might be?
Spice.
Spice, yeah, it is a spice of one sort. Which one? A nice ring structure. Carbon chain, alpha chain coming up inside of it. Pumpkin pie is my favorite food, I mean. That's all I can see. You would know it as a chef as oil of clove. The chemical name is eugenol. One of my favorite odorants since we've been using it lately. It's not just because it's a pumpkin pie. Probably some versions. But my point here, actually, that I want to make, if I can get this to go back, is that notice all these odorants, how discreetly different they are, right? In the sense that the wavelengths of light and vision are like a real number system, the odorants in olfaction are like an integer system with lots of the integers missing, actually. And there's no real continuity between one chemical to the next in a three-dimensional structural sense. This makes a difficult problem for reception, right? You can't make three receptors and cover all the visible spectrum of wavelengths like you can in the cones in your eye. You need some other system to detect this more than 10,000 different things and to be able to detect novel things. So how many receptors are needed to cope with this 10,000 or so odorants, to cope with that diversity of structure you just saw? Come on. In us, we have about 400 functional receptor genes, and about 600 pseudogenes. We know what pseudogenes are, right? These are genes that are recognizably of a certain type, but they've got at least one nucleotide difference that makes them either stop short of full length or mutates them in such a way that they can't make a functional receptor. These are dead genes, they're sometimes called. And there are... Mouse has about 1,100 functional odorant receptors, about 300 pseudogenes. A dog has about 1,000 OR genes and about... it's about 900 and about 300 OR pseudogenes. Dogs are famous for how well they smell, but they're really not all that different from humans, and certainly no different than mouse. How about cows? Cows
have 900 functional odorant receptors and about 1,150 OR pseudogenes. The only other mammal that we know of that has many OR genes total are tree shrews, which have about the same, about 900 functional receptors and about 1,100 pseudogenes. Drosophila have about 62, and C. elegans, the worm, is about 600, or thought to be odorant receptors. They aren't similar to the mammalian ones, and neither are the fly receptors. These actually are a completely different family of genes, these are a completely different family of G-protein covalent receptors, which are what the OR genes are. If you've had some cell biology, you've probably heard of G-protein covalent receptors, which are the super family of the OR genes. Right? So this is the largest family of genes in your genome. In some mammals, it makes up almost 5% of the genes. By far the largest family of genes, and you can see why, or what we just talked about, right? The fact that you've got so many different odorants that you're trying to detect, and the fact that they're so distinctly different, each of them, the odorants. The system has evolved all these receptors to solve that problem, to allow it to keep track of all those odors. And that tells you that odors are really important in the animals. Okay? We tend to forget that because we're so visual. Right. We tend to forget that for most mammals, what they smell is much more important than what they see. It's how they really communicate with each other. We'll talk about that in a little bit of detail here. Right. So connecting these neurons in the nose that have these receptors to the brain. So you've got this olfactory epithelium here. And it sends the axons of its neurons to the brain, to a structure called the olfactory bulb. This is the most anterior part of the brain in most mammals, nearly all animals except us. Our olfactory bulbs sit underneath our huge cranium, cerebrums, that have evolved going out there. And you'll notice that all these blue receptors send their axons to the same spot, and this spot is called a glomerulus, right? And all the red receptors are sitting there, so another spot. It turns out that all the axons of all the neurons expressing the same receptor go to the same glomerulus. Right? This is always true. So that's how we connect up these all those neurons in your nose, and you've got several million. A rabbit has 50 million, a mouse about 5 million neurons. And they all connect up in this way. Why? They connect up according to which receptors they express. But think about that for a second. This system, right, if you have to discriminate two odorants that are different chemicals, or mixtures of chemicals, it doesn't matter either way, what must be happening to this pattern of inputs to the brain? In order to tell one odor from the other.
The spatial separation has to be observed.
There has to be some spatial separation. In other words, this is a spatial map of the odor activation patterns. Very good. Two odorants, in order to be discriminated, for you to tell them apart, all they have to do is to differentially activate at least one of these glomeruli. So that if at least one glomerulus is different, you ought to be able, in terms of being activated, you ought to be able to tell the difference of the two compounds that you've been given to smell. That's all it takes. This is really all the brain does, right? Really all it does is create differences in patterns of activity and associate those patterns of activity with stimuli, such as odors, or outputs, such as being able to catch a baseball, even more difficult, hit a baseball, right? Since it's baseball season. That's really what the brain is about, what the whole nervous system is about. So think about this for a second. about this connection. If each glomerulus receives axons only from receptor neurons expressing the same receptor protein, the same receptor gene, and each neuron sends its axons, and it only has one, sends its only axon to only one glomerulus, how many receptor genes can each neuron express? Connectivity if you're expressing more than one receptor, right? Because if it's expressed one, the receptor determines where it goes, the axon, when it goes to the brain. The only way for that math that I showed you to work is if each neuron expresses only one receptor. This is a very useful point. So if we knew the receptors that the cells in the nose activated by an odor, or if we knew the receptor genes, rather, receptor proteins activated by an odor, we would know how different the pattern of activated glomeruli would be. Right? In order to understand the coding of information, we need to know that which receptors are activated, and that tells us which glomeruli are going to be activated. But unfortunately, we don't have that information now. So this is one of the big areas of research in olfaction, is to determine how information is coded. And the beginning of coding, of course, is detecting the odor. So if we were able to capture all the neurons in the nose that had recently been activated by an odor, what would be true about the receptors they express? Because each receptor neuron expresses only one receptor. If a neuron was activated, then that receptor must have been activated, because the neuron's expressing only one receptor. Right? Very simple logic. The only kind that I ever deal with. Right? So, how do we find out which odorants match which of those in a mouse 1,100 receptors? Well, what I'm going to tell you now, can't tell anybody else. It's never revealed this to anyone else. Okay? It's the first time I've talked about it. In my lab, I made this mouse. This is a gene called S185. It happens to be an activity-dependent gene. We discovered it about 10 years ago now. And I made a mouse in which the gene, which has two axons, was deleted. And in its place, there is this tau GFP. We know what GFP is, right? Green fluorescent protein. Very good. And in fact, you can see, I hope, the green fluorescent protein here expressed in the neurons in the nose. You can see the little bulb at the top. This is the nasal cavity. In that bulb, there are cilia that you can see that come off of that. Right, that's where odor detection takes place. Down here, you can see some faint green. Those are the axons going off to the brain. And you can see that there are actually lots of neurons here, but only some of them are green. Those are recently activated receptor neurons. Now, if we could capture those neurons, right, we would know which receptors have been active just a few hours previously by simple methods of determining which receptor genes, which receptor RNAs were present in the captured neurons. It turns out, like everything we do in my lab, it's actually simple to capture the growing green fluorescent neurons, because you could do a standard technology called fluorescence-activated cell sorting, capture those green neurons. We actually capture both the green neurons out here and the negative or non-fluorescent cells. That allows us to generate a ratio in the amount of receptor RNA in those two samples. And that ratio is a very useful tool. And So here are actual numbers. Here's the ratio for a set of receptors when they were stimulated with this odorant called muscone. Muscone is a famous odorant, right? If you wear perfume, it's very likely that muscone is in that perfume as what's called the basement. It's a big molecule, has a distinctive sort of a little bit musky smell, sort of earthy almost smell, that I find appealing anyway. And again, it's a very important element of perfumes, and I can tell you why later. It's for time's sake, we'll go on. And it turns out that compared to these controls, if you look at vehicle enrichment versus enrichment of the receptor RNAs stimulated by muscone, you get these outliers, and indeed, we now know that most of these are muscone receptors that we identified. In fact, we were able to take this mouse data and look at the homologous mammalian of human genes, rather, and predict which of your receptors respond to muscone. And it turns out there's really only one human receptor that's homologous to these, to this set of mouse receptors that are in color here. And indeed, that mouse receptor respond, that human receptor responds to muscone. So we know now which of your receptors is responding to that component of many of the perfumes you encounter. It's all unpublished stuff. So this is one of the things that's going on in my lab, to try to determine which receptors are activated by which odorants. So we're eventually going to get to the point where we know the patterns of activating the Verilog. So once we do that, do we understand what the brain is doing with the odor input? Because it takes more than just sending information to the first synapse in the brain for your to really do something about having detected an odor. There's much more to it than that. Not really. You need to know a lot more. You need to know that the olfactory bulb sends the information onward to two sets of locations, and we need to know what those two locations are doing with that information. One of the locations are several cortical areas, entorhinal cortex, piriform cortex, etc., and the amygdala, which is a critical emotional center. Which is intriguing to those of us who study olfaction. It's linked to emotional centers. Cortex, conscious effects, your ability to discriminate, to tell one from another. This is something you do consciously. You have to make a conscious decision. But the things that odors do to you that you aren't aware of consciously are things that go through the amygdala. This part of the limbic system, part of the brain that deals with emotional responses. Which, if you think about it, is a little bit scary. The odors you detect could be doing things to you that never come to your consciousness. Your boyfriend or girlfriend. Maybe your boyfriend or girlfriend because you unconsciously like how they smell. And more than just their perfume. Or cologne, whatever. There's not enough work going on in our field about these things, about these unconscious effects of odorants in humans. It's just because the work is very difficult. We know more about this area in animals, however. So let's talk about that a little bit. So I already said that it's possible it has unconscious effects on your behavior. Perhaps we'll know about this. Anybody ever heard of the McClintock effect? Not related to me. This is Martha McClintock, who's at the University of Chicago. When Martha was an undergraduate at Harvard, she did a study that got published in Nature in 1971 about women living together in dormitories having their menstrual cycles come into synchrony. And it was pretty clear that this was done by olfactory cues. In fact, she later went on in 1978 to publish a paper that said that showed that for rats anyway, This was definitely true. The odor cues caused their menstrual cycles to come into greater synchrony when they were living together than when they lived alone. Well, the data that Martha published has never really been substantiated in humans, and there are lots of reasons to think it's really not good. The reanalysis of the data, etc. I'm personally very skeptical. I like Martha tremendously, but...
Are you saying that the data that it's olfactory-based or the data that they're synchrony?
Both, actually.
There's tons of anecdotal data about...
Right, right. But the best mathematical analyses and statistical analyses of the original data and of subsequent data are equivocal. They don't see a significance, unfortunately. Well, you know, up until I looked at it carefully recently, I was under the same impression as you are. I don't fault you for that. It makes a great story, actually. That's a large part of its appeal. And we know that it's true in rats, right? But we can talk about why that might be the case for rats more so than humans in a moment. So what things do olfactory input control? Let's think more generally here. What's controlled by the sense of smell? What things are going to happen to mammals like us when we smell things? What things is it good for? Right? It's critical for suckling. Right? We discovered that again, when we started making knockout mice that were anosmic, that couldn't smell, these mice would die at birth because they couldn't suckle. Until we learned how to overcome that problem, to teach them to suckle at birth, and we got past that problem. So now we can make anosmic mice that grow up to adulthood. Olfaction controls aggressive behavior in many mammals, controls mating behavior, controls parental behavior, controls defensive behavior. It controls a lot of behavior between conspecifics, right? That it doesn't do so much in us, we think. And we can talk about why that might be the case. But these are obviously critical behaviors. Most mammals have a main and an accessory olfactory system, right? You learned this already. However, the old world primates, including humans, lack this accessory system. The accessory system, as you probably already know, is the vomonasal organ, which is always located down here at the base of the septum in mammals. And they send axons to the back of the olfactory bulb, what's called the accessory olfactory bulb. And these send, from here, this information is sent onto the hypothalamus, the amygdala, primarily. Definitely these signals are going to emotional centers and behavioral control centers. So one of the reasons that there could be these differences in what olfaction controls between old world primates like us and most other mammals is this lack of a vomeronasal system in humans. All of your vomeronasal receptor genes, which are different than the odor receptor genes, are dead genes, pseudogenes, except perhaps for one that's misexpressed in the olfactory epithelium. That data is really not all that hard. Not all that good. But just for fun, consider for a second what our behavior would be like if we still had accessory olfactory systems like the rest of mammals. What behaviors would we be doing? Right. What effect would it have on clothing fashions? Would perfume and cologne be illegal? Because these accessory olfactory systems are hardwired into certain kinds of behaviors. Right? And mammals do very unique and specific kinds of behaviors to pick up cues for these accessory olfactory systems, because many of the cues for them are things that are not volatile. Right. Stinky things. Or, what do dogs do when they greet, meet each other, even if they know each other, the first thing they head for, they smell each other. Where do they smell each other?
Their butts.
They smell each other's butts, right? And they're not just, you know, holding it out here, they're doing this, right? They're actually coming in physical contact because they're picking up non-volatile cues, right, that are actually brought into the nasal cavity by mucus flow into the vomeronasal organ and also to the main olfactory epithelium and detected. Things like peptides, other kinds of non-volatile chemicals are picked up by this system. We don't do that, okay? Because our behavior would be very different if we did. Right? Think about what our clothing would be like. You know, we would probably have clothing where, you know, this was cut out. You wouldn't cover your butt because you couldn't communicate with each other. Thank God we didn't evolve. We evolved as we did. We'd be very different, extremely different people, beings, if we hadn't lost this vomeronasal accessory olfactory system. Right? The other thing we would do, and there's another set of glands in most mammals, actually under the eyes, nasal glands, that secrete other important cues. Right? So you notice a lot of dogs and other mammals rubbing faces against each other. Yeah. We would do that. You know, sort of like the Eskimo kiss when they rub noses, only we'd be rubbing our noses against their cheeks. That's a little more appealing than sticking our noses in everybody else's butts. So what do we use instead? Right? We use visual signals. Right? Us and the other old world primates. Here's a mandrill, for example, one of the old world primates. You see this is an alpha male. This is very dominant coloration, you know, on the face and in the genital area, and this red penis. Saying that he's the dominant male, he's red. Here's a female chimpanzee, right? See this genital swelling? Looks painless, huge. This is the signal that, visual signal, it's very pink, that she is receptive for mating. It goes along with her estrous cycle. How about this one? It might do something for half the people in the room, perhaps not for the other half. About, there's a little accelerated heartbeat in about half of the people in the room, etc. Use visual signals. And that, you know, in our behavior, you think about sticking your nose in other people's butts, how weird that would be. Well, what about some of the weird things that we do or have done instead? Cod pieces, thank goodness they're no longer in favor. Dr. Morris will explain what that is later. Building, you know, pumping yourself up through anabolic steroid use and weight training, etc. Those two things for guys. How about high heels, corsets, push-up bras, short shorts, etc. For us, it's the visual signals that are supplanted some of these signals that were originally in mammals. You sent through the accessory olfactory system. We digress. Today's topic is really not vision but olfaction. Right, so let's move on to the second thing that's unique about the olfactory system. And that is adult neurogenesis. And we said this was unique and rare. And indeed it is. Why is it rare? Why not? Think about the advantages of being able to make new neurons in an adult human like me. Or you. Think about how you could use it to learn new things. You know? I need to learn all this crap in sensory biology. I'm going to grow some more neurons and store it there. Right? What if you had a neurodegenerative disorder, like Parkinsonism or Alzheimer's disease, or you were a suffered neurotrauma, right? And damaged neurons in the brain. Boy, let's grow some new ones and replace those. Wouldn't that be cool? Well, we think that might eventually be possible, because it certainly is true that adult neurogenesis is possible and occurs in the olfactory system and a couple other places. But there may be reasons why it didn't evolve. Right? So these are what we're thinking about for the reason. Maybe the brain of complex mammals like us is too complex itself, right? To be able to for new neurons to be born in and be incorporated into the circuitry in those places. Maybe because the brain changes during maturation in ways that the landmarks to tell the axons where to go to connect are gone. We know that that's true, but and certainly if we were going to use adult neurogenesis, we would have to overcome this problem. Maybe the memory circuits that must last a lifetime would be disrupted by new neurons being incorporated. Our ability to remember motor tasks like catching a baseball, as I said, or to remember what your grandmother's face looked like, or other kinds of things that are critical for you, would be disrupted if we did adult neurogenesis. Maybe there's really no mechanistic prohibition at all. It's just that our inability to do adult neurogenesis in most of our brain is an accident of evolution. Maybe there's a way that we can recover this ability. These are all things that people are thinking about. Because adult neurogenesis would be useful in several ways. You can learn and form new memories, as I said a moment ago. You could replace damaged neurons. But the only place right now that we know that replacing damaged neurons evolved is the olfactory epithelium. You have some interneurons in your brain, in the olfactory bulb, and in the dentate gyrus and hippocampus that are replaced, where new neurons are born and sent there. But those appear to be two small examples, the only other examples of adult neurogenesis. And they are examples of adult neurogenesis that happens in order for new memories to be formed. It helps facilitate new memory formation. It does not appear to be a place where damaged neurons are replaced. It's only in the olfactory epithelium that damaged neurons are replaced. Because your olfactory epithelium, your neurons are exposed, man. They're hanging out there almost in the air. Right? They are experiencing all these chemicals that the system works hard to concentrate. Now, you know that if you get too much odorant in your nose, something you can smell, you have too much of it around, you can kill the nerve cells in your nose. Your olfactory neurons will die. They're exposed to pathogenic bacteria and viruses, indirect physical insults, and maybe even high oxygen tension, generating oxidative stress, although that idea has never really been tested in animals or humans. So I did list it here. You'll be able to know that that's a factor. So if we're going to do adult neurogenesis as we do in our noses, there has to be some neural stem cells, right? Some kind of tissue-level stem cells. And indeed there are. And they're located here. There's a basement membrane called the basal lamina. And right on top of that are basal progenitor cells. And some of those are indeed neural stem cells. The immature neurons lie on top of that, the mature neurons lie on top of that, and then the cell bodies of these glial-like support cells lie on top of that, and then the mucus is apical on top of that. So here, in all its glory, is the cell lineage, right? Early and embryonic olfactory epithelium, when the pit first forms, there are these apical neuroepithelial cells, just like everywhere else in the nervous system, that start to give rise to neurons. And they also give rise to these cells that come and sit against the basement membrane. These are epithelial cells. Neuroepithelial cells are gone by the time, certainly by birth, most mammals, and by mid-gestation in most of them, leaving you these basal cells, horizontal cells and globose basal cells. And there are at least two populations of multipotent neural stem cell-like cells, one filled with these flat basal cells, some of them with these round basal cells. And they give rise to the neurons in this characteristic cell lineage, which we know a lot about, but not nearly enough to be able to control what the cell types do. So if you're going to do adult neurogenesis therapeutically, you've got to be able to control where these cells go and how they differentiate and get them to the right target in the end. We need to know a lot more about that. It's a very active area of research, right? And one of the ways it's done, for example, is to cause synchronous replacement of all the mature neurons. This is a system where if you take out the olfactory bulb, you put a little hole in the skull, suck out the olfactory bulb, it severs all the axons, all the mature neurons die, and that stimulates all those basal cells to proliferate. And you get this response shown here. Mature neurons die, you get increased production of immature neurons because the basal cells proliferate more rapidly. So there's all this signaling that's going on to control proliferation of these basal cells and the rate of differentiation of the neurons. And we understand part of that, but not all of it. Right? So that's very active area of research. These signals of mature neurons that suppress proliferation of the basal cells. There are signals from the dying mature neurons. There are signals from the microRNAs that are involved. There are signals from the integrated macrophages. And of course, the control of transcription in the basal cells, right, to determine the fate of these neurons is critical. So in my lab, we're pursuing these questions by doing functional genomics. We purify specific cell types. So these are more mice that have GFP in specific places in the nervous, specific cell types. We purify them to determine which genes are expressed in which cell types. We have these fancy tables where we can say, okay, the probability that this gene is expressed in the mature neurons is 1. We know it's expressed in the neurons. And these genes here, probably not at all, they're expressed in both mature and immature, or they're expressed in the other cell types, like here, meaning the basal cells or the sustentacular cells. So this is one of the things that's going on in my lab, is to identify the expression pattern of every gene in the olfactory, which cell types express each one. We've done 2 cell types thus far. And we get these fancy patterns that look like this, which I showed just because it's pretty. I'm trying to blow up here. You can go on past that. And from this knowledge of cell types, we're able to build up this is data that we've just submitted for publication. A picture of the progression of biological processes that are necessary for adult neurogenesis to happen. Right? In the basal cells, we know the genes that are involved in fate determination, at least some of them, the transcriptional regulation and signaling, the proliferation and signaling. The things that are involved in the axon initiation of the brand new neurons, which we call mason neurons. The immature neurons and all the processes that are going on there. And some of those processes start in the immature neurons and carry over into the mature neurons, and then there are things that happen at the very end of maturation. So we now have this progression of the major events that are going on and the genes that are involved. And so what we hope in the future is to use that knowledge and to force adult neurogenesis of a damaged brain, but we're a long way from that. Lots of new hurdles to overcome. We know the general events that must be regulated. We don't know how to specifically control them, right? Because it's not only transcription factors that we've studied and continue to study. It's also the chromatin remodeling, the epigenetics, that's critical for controlling gene expression that we need to understand that. Right? We're worried about oncogenic transformation anytime you do this kind of cell-based therapy. So that's where we stand, and sort of a vignette of where the field stands at this point.
There's a lot of interest in for cell-based therapies in taking iPS cells and differentiating them in the dish and the transplant. And so can you take iPS cells and make olfactory sensory neurons and compare those to that differentiation?
You know, no one's ever tried to do that in the nose, and that's interesting, right? Because that would seem logical, because it is possible, especially in mice, to transplant proliferating progenitor cells, at least, into the olfactory epithelium and have them become neurons. But those have all been basal cells that have been harvested from one mouse's nose and put in another mouse's nose. Right? There's a lot of work going on trying to use olfactory neural stem cells and put them in other tissues. And no one's done, as far as I know, the iPS cells.
In terms of comparing like directed differentiation into something like
right.
taking the molecules that you've already identified, how then we try to tweak the system to get a different type of.
I agree. Would a non-differentiated multipotent cell from somewhere else, like bone marrow, or an induced pluripotent cell, as you said, from anywhere else, mm-hmm. Be capable of becoming an olfactory neuron?
Where does the signal originate? So is it a signal from the dying neuron, or is it coming from?
Well, there.
Because that would depend, right? So then.
Right. Well, it depends on what the experiment Anne is asking about is asking is whether a non-differentiated cell put into the olfactory epithelium would respond to all the cues, and there are many of them that are present in the olfactory epithelium, would respond appropriately to those cues to form the kind of neuron that is needed in the tissue, an olfactory neuron. And that is a very intriguing experiment, and no one has published it yet or shown it at a meeting that I've been to, at least.
What about the house, these diseases that you mentioned at the very beginning, the Parkinson's and others? Is it a problem in the epithelium, or is it higher up in not maybe giving the signals down to the regeneration?
We don't know. It's clearly not that the olfactory epithelium has died. And it appears to be one of multiple defects in synapses in multiple places. But there's no good, hard, and fast answer to your question yet as to where that defect lies in the Parkinsonism or the dementia or the loss of the sense of smell. It's not been a simple, look, all the neurons are gone in the nose.
Are you finding that some of the lobster work that you did before coming together with helping out with the mammalian models, or is it so different?
In a small sense, there are similarities, but none of them have been particularly helpful in seeding new knowledge. Now, my PhD advisor did discover that phosphoinositide phospholipids, phosphatidyl inositols, regulate the ion channels that are opened by the odorants, the transduction channels, the first electrical signal that happens in the nose. He discovered that those are regulated by these phospholipids in lobsters and was able to show that it was also true in mammals. So there's one good example where something very useful was identified recently. Anybody have a friend or family member who has a smell disorder? They're not. You have one.
My roommate thinks so.
Smell as a result of an accident or just unknown origin?
No, he's got Wardenburg syndrome.
Is Wardenburg syndrome?
Wardenburg.
That's one of the characteristics.
I don't know that one.
Isn't
that? Yeah. Huh? Did that develop? Was that from birth, or did it develop later in life?
It was wrong with that. From, I think, his clothes will smell bad, or sometimes, hey, it's time to do laundry.
Quality of life is tied up very much in the sense of smell. In fact, here's a question for you. Deaf, blind, and
don't have a good word for it, like, you know. This is sad, but suicide rate.
Which one's the highest?
So the bottom.
Right? People have smell disorders in general are at greater risk of suicide than people who are deaf or people who have blindness. People find that hard to believe. But if you ever talk to somebody who's had the smell disorder, especially phantosmia, where this happens to many people who've lost their sense of smell as adults, you know, car accident, or they took that zinc anti-cold medicine that they sprayed into into the noses about 15, 20 years ago. I forget what was the name of that thing, darn it. It's either a toxic chemical or an injury, lost their sense of smell. Many of them recover their sense of smell eventually, but some of those people get these phantosmias. And usually they believe that they are smelling really bad things, dead bodies, you know, feces. It's awful. And there are severe emotional disruptions in many people who lose their sense of smell as adults. It's a serious issue.
You said there's regeneration of some of these olfactory epithelial cells, so why wouldn't... I guess, do all of them come back?
No.
If they're smelling certain...
No, they don't all come back. And there are two reasons for that. Why, I mean, we can make new neurons in the nose, why doesn't their smell come back? Two reasons. One, this usually happens with chemical damage, is that the chemical damage was so severe that it killed the stem cells in the nose, those basal cells, right? So they can't regenerate the neurons. What's most common in people who have like a car accident and they sever because the brain moves relative to the, you know, those axons, the nerves have to go through the skull, and that can cause shearing. The brain gets moved, you know, you get a brain injury. Shear that nerve, what can happen is scar tissue can form there from astrocytes, and the new axons can't get through it. And so they never reconnect, even though they make new neurons. So those are the two main causes for why they don't recover their sense of smell. People who are aged, extreme aged, 80, 90, 100, can often lose their sense of smell just because their stem cells eventually give out. And so we see malnutrition in a certain percentage of these patients, right? Just as you learned with your test of your candy, right? That much of the reward of eating is actually the smell of the food. These people, Asian people, don't get proper nutrition because they're getting no feedback, no reward for eating. They're not getting that sensory stimulation that they need. So we teach them to eat spicy foods, right, which is not olfactory, and to get reward that way. You have to add hot pepper to everything you eat.
How about when you're aging? You mentioned one sensory type of receptor for one neuron. But when you're aging in the regeneration, do you lose some of those types of receptors, or are you keeping the whole gamut?
You keep the whole gamut as far as we can tell. We don't know for exactly, but usually your ability to discriminate things doesn't degrade specifically, you know, faster than other things. In fact, there are experiments with rats where they remove 90% of the olfactory bulb, and the rats are still really good at making odor discrimination tech. Now that pattern of activation, you really need an actual subset of that pattern to be able to do most olfactory tasks. The pattern of glomeruli being activated is truly remarkable. In fact, for a long time, this guy's experiments were not believed. He can't be right.
We can
take away 90% and it still works. That's a lot of redundancy. Think an engineer built it or something. But it evolved. It wasn't engineered.
Well, any questions for Tim?
I've asked you questions about emotional things.
Yeah.
At the end here, where we talked about this kind of stuff and date danger of suicide, that's, you know, really, in fact, just as critical. effects on emotional well-being.
What do you think about, like, we talked a little bit about people being too clean these days, you know? And they have,
I don't know.
Or your European style.
The main effect of epithelium is a learning device, especially for humans. It's really built for making associations between an odor and an experience. This is why you get those full color, who mentioned that? Full color, vivid memories to some odors. You ever had that happen? Where you unexpectedly have this vivid visual memory of something triggered by an odor. Many people have experienced this. I've only experienced it once myself, just once. I was amazed at how powerful it was. If you haven't yet, you probably will. And that's just an example of what olfaction is built to do, to make those strong associations, right? You smell something that ends up making you sick when you eat it, you want to remember, oh, I remember that smell. I'm not eating this, right?
All right. Well, you got a question.
Yes.
Has there been much work on how the processing goes on where the olfactory bulb projects to different parts of the brain? Like how the behavior is modulated through that?
There's lots of work going on those issues. And we just don't understand enough about the circuits yet that control what's thrown with the information once you get past the bulb. What is the difference in pattern at the cortex between two odors? We don't even understand that yet, really. There's not a beautiful logic to it the way there is to that pattern in the bulb. No one's asked about the link between the olfactory system and the cerebrum, those big cerebrums that we evolved. It's thought that those evolved out of the olfactory areas of the brain in mammals. Because there are only two synapses, right? Receptor neuron to the bulb and the bulb to the cortex. Every other sense, there's at least three synapses to get to the cortex. It's one of the major reasons we think that the cerebrums evolved from olfactory areas in the brain. So, a lot of it may be that the way that we think, those kinds of all of the complex things we associate with being very human, are patterns of information processing that were evolutionarily evolved to deal with odor stimuli and to integrate that with everything else that was coming in. So, I don't have a good answer for your question. I'm just riffing here on what I know. Which ain't that much.
That's very good. Well, let's thank Tim for a wonderful time.
And remember to get in some drafts soon, hopefully.
Okay. If you have it, I already put it great on some drafts and
outlines are all in, that's great. Papers, the sooner you get them done, the better. And we can go over and give you feedback too. And they're looking really good. It's a nice topic that you've had. And,